Human beings are something like caterpillars that spend their time eating and getting fat with to the point where they start weaving a cocoon around themselves. Chrysalis, encasement. So the hunger of human beings feeds on ideas. It's hard for people to find, to treat things differently than that kind of food. They hear Zen and they hear Buddhism and they say, that's an interesting idea, that makes sense. Reminds me of, and so on. Nothing wrong with that. It's just what human beings do. Caterpillars eat and get fat. And then they weave a cocoon around themselves, a chrysalis. Now, I bet caterpillars don't really know why they do that. It's just their nature. The analogy breaks down, obviously. But the significance of any ideas about Zen, about self, and about what life is, and the meaning of life, and all the stories of Zen, and the stories of Buddhism, and so on. One of the first things we have to realize in the practice of Zen is not to take these as anything other than pointers. They're actually nothing but just more stories. Zen is unlike so many other religions that take their stories and they reify them. They kill people that aren't accepting that these are real things, solid things, actual statements of the way the world is. So-called holy wars, holy catastrophes, going on all the time, will probably go on all the time, because the fundamental nature of human beings is division. As long as there is division, you get all the products of division. You get the wanting and the yearning and the self-criticism and the self-adulation and the tribal activities and the expulsion of those not in your tribe and the killings and so on and so on. All products of the fundamental nature of human beings, which is to be divided. Everything follows from that. Things we might call good stuff. Development of ways to help people. Ways to destroy people. Entertainments, all kinds of things, all fundamentally are based upon this fundamental fact of human beings, which in Buddhism is called fundamental ignorance. Fundamental ignorance. Unavoidable. We human beings have what's called self-consciousness. The whole culture based upon this and that. Children are taught to identify with self all kinds of ways. Blame arises, guilt arises, resentment arises, all fundamentally based upon this fact. Zen points to this, has always pointed to it, fundamentally in the greatest of the Zen teachings. It's all about directing the attention to the fundamental presuppositions of our life. And not being fooled, as we sometimes say, by the leaves of the tree. But what are the roots? Upon what is our life of separation based? And Zen is concerned with transforming this basis upon which we live our life. And it's one hell of a job because of the momentum of belief in, we might call them, superficialities. And the rewards of believing in these superficialities, the momentary supports that they bring, and the fact that we can get high on them when we figure something out, when something goes into the right slot. And as we say, there's nothing bad about that. It's fine. As long as you don't base your life upon it. Your fundamental life. Zen introduces this new idea. The Buddha introduced it, but it got lost among all the rituals and memorizing of sutras and all the rest of it. And Zen carried this torch forward. What the Buddha pointed out, that fundamentally every human being is full and complete, is, we might say, Buddha. Is the bottom line. Fundamentally, a place beyond all duality, including birth and death. And all the effort of teaching in Zen is to help individuals to point, not to sell ideas, not to provide one more comfort of building a nice quilt of comfortable ideas about Buddhism. Not to sing songs about it, make hymns about it. But to open the being beyond all delusions, beyond, if we may use our caterpillar analogy, beyond the constraints of the chrysalis. I don't know about caterpillars that are transforming, growing wings of all things in this crawly being, growing wings and all kinds of different kinds of appendages inside this chrysalis. I don't know if they know what the hell is going on. What's happening to me? My God. But in Zen, we try to identify this encasement and try to help individuals to undo the process of building and relying upon this casement, this encasement, and trust that if you don't do that, you can touch the source of your life and ultimately live from that source. But people are so habituated to the attachment to this encasement, to their comfortable ideas of identification with race and role in society and tribe, and a bunch of ideas and a whole set of identified patterns of behavior and emotional response and all those things, that they don't realize that this is just a story. This is not who they are. So fundamentally, we start by trying to get people to realize that. Look inside. Look inside. See upon what base, fundamentally, is anything that you say that you are. I am a this, I am a that, I am a role, I am a whatever it is. Look and find what you have to do in order to maintain that. And finally, does that walk you? Does that breathe you? Is that the source from which your responses come, and your ideas and your thoughts and your words and your breath? Is it from that place that they come? And anyone being honest about the inquiry will say, well, no, it's not. And people can take that as a scary place. I don't want to go there. Don't go there. You go crazy. But they take it as a real, exciting beginning of a voyage of discovery. What is it then? And that's the arising of the fundamental koan of our existence. Fundamental to the teaching of Buddhism. You are Buddha. You are full and complete. You are not any of these things with which you can identify. You, fundamentally, the one that you truly are, is beyond birth and death. And then, this comes right up against the wall, the encasement. What's this bullshit, beyond birth and death? Look, I'm starting to get infirm, and you know, my friends are starting to die off. I mean, everybody is going to die, aren't they? You point to anyone who hasn't died? Well, there's all that Lazarus stuff, but I wasn't there. And it's touching. It's so, so touching that people, and there are institutions called churches, that fundamentally sell a consolation against the voyage of discovery. Consolation. Try to reinforce it by hymns and by nice words, whatever it is. So this is fundamentally what sin is. So everybody has to observe that within their own being. Everything that is produced in your mind is a manifestation. We start by saying it's a product of Buddha nature. There is no other source. So everything produced by it, be it your body, be it your thoughts, be your emotional responses, whatever it may be it your memories, be it your construction business, it's all coming from this source. It is a product of Buddha nature. But more than that, just as a product of a factory, you could also call it is a manifestation of the factory. There's no significance of the factory if it were not for the manifestations, the products. In fact, the true factory is its manifestations. It is the products. Got a car company that had a sign on it, this is a car company that produces the best cars in the world, but there was no assembly line. It didn't produce cars. It would be silly, of course. So the manifestation of the true factory is what it produces. So to call it a production is just a temporary word. It is a manifestation of it. It is, in fact, the factory. So likewise, everything that is produced by the mind, be it emotional responses, be it thoughts and memories and whatever it may be, is the fabric of this Buddha nature. It's another aspect of this great koan. How can that be so? Now, I did not say that the content of the ideas that are produced are fundamentally true. I just said that they are produced is a manifestation of this Buddha nature. They came about by causes and conditions that were unavoidable, that are necessary. They arise not out of your volition, but as a result of these mysterious processes that go on in the unconscious mind and through the interaction of this sentient being and the so-called environment. They arise out of things that you couldn't predict. You can't predict from one moment to the next what thoughts will arise, what emotional responses you'll have. Because there is no you to control it. It arises like the weaving of a great fabric. And you, endowed with sentience, endowed with conscious awareness. Whatever that may be, we don't know. Can notice it. And because people are divided beings, and because they come equipped with an almost inexhaustible supply of Velcro, they attach. That's me. That's who I am. I just had a thought. The fact that I have a thought, remember Descartes, I think, therefore I am. Because I had a thought, that is a demonstration that I exist. I, in fact, am my thoughts. Others may have said, I feel, therefore I am. Well, there's something that's not quite wrong with that. As long as you don't apply the Velcro. It's the Velcro is the thing. That's why the fundamental thing that people contend with within their Zen practice is this funny thing that we call attachment. Sometimes I call it the glue or the Velcro. The attachment. The hunger of this divided mind to have healing. To come into oneness. Not to be divided. The wonderful thing. It's just directed in the wrong direction. So when a thought comes in that says, I am an accomplished person. It's not that that thought has any validity. It's just a story. It's just what happened to come together within the field of consciousness. And we urge people practicing Zen to just let it come and go. Open all the doors and windows and let them float in as they float out. And float out as they flow in. To treat them differently is all in the attitude. That's what washes away the Velcro, the glue, that heals us of settling for attachment instead of finding out what we are. So it is not that any of these things that come into the mind have in themselves any validity with respect to any substantial reality. I am defective. I am unable. I am supremely able. I am a warrior. I will conquer this. It's all just stories. And temporarily, some of it might be useful. I will go forth and wrestle with this demon mind. Not a bad thing at certain stages in practice. I will raise the sword of Manjushri against all those weeds that want to take root in my garden. Not so bad at certain times in practice. But there's nothing permanent about any of them. They are applicable in certain circumstances. And certain things are inhibitory, like I am defective, like I can't do it. But even those, if you drive them into the ground, drive them into the ground, really drive them into the ground. Who is this I? What do I mean by defective? How do I know that? They become nothing. They vanish. They are inaccessible. Do you realize that they are just arising from this wonderful process that we human beings do? We select certain items from our memory store. We link them together. We neglect vast numbers of others. And we have a criterion that guides us in the linking. We link them because we're building this particular story. And that came from somewhere. Something, somebody said it sometime. Some attitudinal frame that was there in our upbringing or in our schooling or later on, who knows? It's all just derived from that, and we distorted certain other facts. That didn't really show I was competent. That really was just a demonstration of my incompetence, if you really look at it carefully. And so we do deletion, distortion, and then we generalize and make this link of things, and then we identify it. The glue is in there, and the Velcro attaches, and it gives certain consolations, and it passes the time, and the years go by. And we don't touch what it is that we really are. And the encasement becomes thicker. The old adage about the old dogs and new tricks. I'm not sure that's true of old dogs. But it certainly seems to be true of human beings who have a hunger to get things settled, you know, to like really, really like solve this problem. and then we defend it. As they say, believing something in spite of the data. This is the story of human beings. And if there's a group of people that identify with a certain kind of mode of being, a certain set of stories, then it's very tempting to denigrate all those that don't believe it. In order what? In order to solve duality. It's annoying to have others that challenge us by believing something different. Though you excommunicate them or exclude them or you kill them. Or you move to a different country the way folks came from Europe to America, killed off the Native Americans and all the rest of them. Trying to find unification, trying to heal this duality, but doing it by a very benighted, if not stupid way, horrific way, painful way. That's the story of all the Holocausts that have plagued our world. Fundamentally, when one sees that, one has to be very, very careful, because we too are human beings. And we, as we sit on the cushion, even undertaking this practice of Zen that is intended to go beyond this pernicious process of furthering the consequences of duality, we have to be very careful. That's why we say, don't be fooled. Wake up. Because it is a dream. A dream is populated by things that don't exist, but they're all real. Everybody who's been in an intense dream knows that the dream's real. Changes the heartbeat, influences the autonomic nervous system, might lead to certain hallucinations once you so-called wake up. But nonetheless, it's insubstantial. It does not have the substance of a tree, of a floor, of a carpet, of a living, breathing, bleeding human being. They have no substance, but they're real. They have an effect. This is why we say, awake, wake up. That's why all of Zen is about waking up and not being fooled. And all the teaching is a pointer in that direction, a help in that regard. And none of it is absolute. When we say, as we said last night, holding the mind like an iron wall, a very benevolent statement of Bodhidharma, hold the mind against these things like an iron wall, it's good. It's good as long as you feel the intensity of this duality and the torment. Of these thoughts, feelings, dreams, impinging upon one, to hold the mind like an iron wall or take up the sword of Manjushri and so on. Good thing. But it's not a permanent description of what the practice of Zen is. The practice of Zen, like life, is constantly flowing and changing. And one must adapt one's approach at every moment to the circumstances. And you are the one that must adapt it. It does not come from having a rule. But it comes from having a toolkit. And it would be as foolish to try to use a hammer for a screwdriver, or a screwdriver for a hammer, as it would be to continually decide that what you have to do is hold the mind like an iron wall against thoughts. So Zen is about this other great thing. It is about the empowerment of an individual. Individuals are suppressed by rules, by ideas, by beliefs. The fundamental being, what you really are, has been suppressed, forced to contract, forced to identify with a diminished, identifiable self, rather than to expand to the boundarylessness of what it is to be a human being. And then to take on, if it's appropriate to one's karma, to take on the so-called limitations, to wear the clothing of certain circumstances in order to be in accord with one's karma, one's situation in life. Now this is a fundamental shift in the way that we approach our life. And it enables us, fundamentally, to practice Zen at all times. For life does not come in compartments. The compartment of the Zendo. This is but a place temporarily marked off as special in order to cultivate a certain attitudinal frame towards the life that comes to us at each moment, so that we may better use it under all circumstances. It's a place of learning how not to be fooled. It's a place of learning to be encouraged. A place of learning how to sniff out and affirm that there is this that we call Buddha nature, fundamental nature, faced before your parents were born. There is this which is worth it. That's worth everything. That's worth waking up to all our favorite ideas and realizing they are but stories. They are but stories. And to evaluate them with respect to what do they lead to? Do they actually lead to the accomplishment of a good goal? Do we apply, let's say, the scientific approach to them? That is to say, continually update our stories in order to make them more efficacious in reaching certain laudable goals? Or do we just believe them and not examine them and not penetrate underneath them to find what presuppositions there are upon which they are based? Do we really want that? All the time, accepting that this very discourse, do we really want that, has within itself presuppositions also, but not to tie ourselves up with that. Words, we use them. We humbly use them. Not to be like the famous centipede that just drew a lump in a ball, was unable to move because it wondered if he moved the 85th leg before the 83rd. Don't worry about those things. This brings us to another point, and that is Zen is sloughing off these encasements so that we may become more resonant. I would say more sentient. We say the teaching of Buddhism is for the sake of all sentient beings. But what is sentience? Sentience is able to sense something. Being awake enough, having one's senses with one enough, that one is starting to be able to perceive with accuracy. Sentience, resonance. And when you do resonate, maybe it's resonating to a verbal description, maybe it's resonating to something that as you look out in the morning, as you wake up, you look out in the morning and you see something and it, just for a moment, just for a minute, who knows? It reminds you. Things are not the names I put upon them. Things are not the stories I make up about them. There is a something. Ah! Whatever it is that can encourage one, this is part of the resonance, the awakening, the capacity to resonate and be sentient. So it's not just getting rid of identifications. There's a function in that. Because that allows one's conscious attention to be turned elsewhere. not to the maintenance of a, a comfortable structure in which to live, but rather to this process of listening, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, seeing, as one develops this capacity to resonate, and finally this capacity to resonate, you disappear so much, that is to say, you have sloughed off these encasements sufficiently, that there is what we call in Zen a purity of mind. A purity of mind means not busied with all this shit. All this ideas and stories and identifications and all the rest of it, let it go. It's a matter of becoming simple. And when that happens, anything can awaken you to what is, because what is never departs from you. It is here all the time. But we layer it over with names and stories, and that reminds me of, and oh, it is so tiresome. And that's why I speak of the 11,000-year-old man. If you've been around long enough, you, as they say, have seen it all. How to arrive at that place where you've seen it all before you have to get to be 11,000 years old? How do you do that? You do it by the habit of observing. What are the presuppositions upon which this thought I just had, this feeling, this memory, this whatever is based? What is it all about? Am I doing the same thing over and over, weaving this encasement? Or can I afford to just open the windows and doors and let them all float through without applying any thought? Am I willing to take that step? The step into mystery. The step into I don't know. The step into I don't need to understand everything. Because understanding is just creating a framework. I can have the capacity to understand. And I can now choose to apply it in whatever circumstance it's appropriate, but I don't have to do it rampantly, because that imprisons me. There's no more space in the consciousness for anything else but this rampant construction and solidification of understanding. This is the practice of Zen. Always reminding oneself of that. Hearing old Master Zuigon. You've all heard the story. Koan. Number 12 in the Mumonkan. Up gets Master Zuigon every morning and says to himself, Master? He says, yes. What's presupposed in that? That there is a master in there. There is the one who is capable of waking up or not. There is the one who is not fooled. Acknowledge it. Yes, says Suikar. And he says, are you awake? Ah. Are you still dreaming? Still saying, oh, this is Monday morning. One more Monday morning. Well, it'll soon be Friday, and I have the weekend again. Oh, shit, this morning I have to go and... What are you saying? Morning. If you need to later on, for the sake of some particular function of your karma, to identify the particular Monday, of course that's fine. But now you do it in a different way. Suzuigan asks himself, are you awake? After a pause, wherein this kind of thing probably went on, he says, yes, I am. This is a time of identifying. What's my job here? My fundamental job is not to be fooled. My fundamental job is to not let myself be pulled around by the nose, by ideas and thoughts and memories and all these sorts of things, but to use them. They are there for use. By whom? By the master. Not a master that wields a whip, but by fundamentally who you are. And then finally he says to himself, don't be fooled by anyone. And realizing that that includes himself, he says, no, I will not. And thus launches his day. This is an attitudinal frame for the practice of Zen. Watch this mind. Notice how it's continually engaging in its favorite occupation of the construction business. Just notice it with compassion, with kindness, with the acknowledgement that one is a human being. And what else did you expect when you have a resident mind that functions this way? But be able to walk outside the factory and open all the doors and windows and breathe the air of your practice. Trust in it. We say in Zen, if you work hard in this way, the Dharma will never let you down. The Dharma realizes the total insubstantiality, the absolute irrelevance of any thought that you might have about being incapable. It doesn't have any validity at all. We'll end there today.